Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Kevin, let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
Today on the podcast, we're lucky enough to have Dr. Bill Long of Emmanuel Legacy Hospital in Portland, Oregon, one of the founders of trauma care and instituting trauma systems throughout the U.S. So he's going to talk to us a little about the history and where we came from coming into the 60s and 70s with very limited trauma centers to where we are now. And he's also going to take us through the management of a few traumatic injuries. But first, our opening shot.
All right, today's opening shot is on ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which is a form of mechanical cardiopulmonary support, which, you know, most times we think about cardiopulmonary support, we talk about when it's applied intraoperatively to facilitate cardiac surgery. However, the same type of support can be also delivered in a more prolonged fashion in an intensive care unit, although this is less common, using ECMO. So, Jason, what types of ECMO are there?
Well, there's really two main types. There's veno-arterial, VA, and veno-venous, VV. So during veno-arterial ECMO, blood is extracted from the right atrium and returned to the arterial system, bypassing the heart and lungs. Veno-arterial ECMO provides both respiratory and hemodynamic supports. With venous ECMO, blood is extracted from the vena cava or right atrium and returned to the right atrium. Venous ECMO provides respiratory support, but the patient is dependent on his or her own hemodynamics. Both provide respiratory support, but only veno-arterial ECMO provides the hemodynamic support in addition.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, we already talked about some of the indications there, but Kevin, can you give us the defined indications for ECMO?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. It's one of the few straightforward things about ECMO. If you have acute severe cardiac or pulmonary failure that is potentially reversible, which is a key point, and unresponsive to conventional management, you should consider these patients for ECMO. You should consider these patients early, and you should talk to the ECMO centers early so you guys can arrange transport to get them there. And at least in our institution, we've seen a number of patients, young patients, otherwise healthy, that have had severe ARDS, unresponsive to rescue maneuvers. And these are the patients that we've transported out and have done very well on ECMO. So the things to keep in mind, though, is ECMO may not be initiated if anticoagulation is contraindicated. So if they have a head bleed, if they had recent surgery, these are patients that you want to, you know, they can't have ECMO, so you need to keep working with your other methods you have at your hospital. And then if this is an old sick patient, if the cause of the respiratory or cardiac failure is irreversible, or the patient is not a potential candidate for an implantable ventricular assist device, these patients likely won't do well with ECMO.
Yeah, you know, and when we start talking about ECMO, it seems like a very overwhelming topic for, you know, early clinicians who don't really have much familiarity with it, or if you don't really use it at your institution. So, you know, the best way to go and actually understand ECMO is to talk about the technique. So, Jason, can you kind of run us through, if we're going to put a patient on ECMO, how would we do it?
Sure. So, you know, the patient's first anticoagulated with IV heparin, and then the various cannulae are inserted. So cannulas are usually placed the same way you'd place a central line with, by Seldinger's technique. And with the largest cannulas that can be placed in the vessels possible are used to give you the most volume. So with venous, the right common femoral is usually accessed for drainage, and the right internal jugular is accessed for infusion. In veno-arterial, the venous cannula is placed in the inferior vena cava or right atrium. This is used for drainage. And an arterial cannula is placed in the right femoral artery for infusion. So after you've placed your lines, the patient's connected to the ECMO circuit, and the blood flow through the circuit is increased until respiratory and hemodynamic parameters are dialed in correctly. You sustain the patient, has to be anticoagulated throughout this with a continuous infusion of heparin. Usually your activated clotting time goal is 180 to 210 seconds with a PTT of 1.5 times normal. A couple important things to remember is that platelets are continuously being consumed by the ECMO unit because they're activated through the exposure to the foreign body surface materials. And in an effort to reduce barotrauma and volutrauma and ventilator-associated lung injury, the ventilator settings are usually reduced to a minimal while the patient is on ECMO, as well as to avoid oxygen toxicity.
Okay, so, you know, we did all this work. We got this patient transferred to an ECMO center. We got them on the ECMO circuit. And Kevin, how do we know when these patients are ready to come off of the ECMO for both respiratory failure and cardiac failure?
Right. This is another intuitive part. It's when their signs of their respiratory failure or their heart failure are improving. So you look for the traditional things. You look at their chest x-rays. If their chest x-rays look like the ARDS is improving, and that's one indication among many. If their pulmonary compliance on the ventilator is improved, and if their ABG, if their arterial oxyhemoglobin saturation indicate improvement, the patient may be considered to be liberated if they're on it for respiratory reasons. For the patients that had cardiac failure, you look for aortic pulsatility, which correlates with improved left ventricular output and indicates that the patient may be ready to be liberated from the ECMO.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. And, you know, in every single, you know, medical procedure we do, there's always complications. And then even in ECMO, there's specific complications. Jason, can you give us a rundown of those?
Sure. So you kind of have two ends of the spectrum. You're dealing with somebody who's hypercoagulable on the system, and you're anticoagulating them. So on one side of the spectrum, you have your thromboembolic complications. On the other side, you have your bleeding complications. So bleeding can occur in up to 30 to 40% of patients who are on ECMO. And it can be life-threatening. And this is, unfortunately, just one of the side effects of having to have them so anticoagulated while they're on the system. On the other side, you have the thromboembolic. So you have thrombus that can form within the extracorporeal circuit, and sometimes these complications can be quite devastating. As with you know, any invasive procedure, you can have damage to any of the surrounding structures that can occur during placement of the different cannula. You can have arterial injuries, venous injuries. And then, as with any patient who's receiving heparin, you're always there's a complication of HIT is a possibility.
All right, that was a great summary of extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, otherwise known as ECMO.
So, Kevin, for most parents, the sound of a crying baby is one of the worst sounds in the world. But did you know that there are some areas of the world where this is actually a good thing? Have you heard of this?
No, crying babies is a good thing. Never heard of it.
Well, actually, not surprisingly, this occurs in Japan. There is an annual festival in which sumo wrestlers will hold babies in the air and try and scare them in order to induce them into crying. And parents not only sign their children up for this, they pay pretty good dollars in order for have the opportunity for their babies to participate in this. The festival is held annually, and sumo wrestlers hold babies in the air to see which cries the loudest and the loudest and for the longest amount of time. It's a competition. Should the babies choose not to participate, a referee then enters the arena and attempts to scare them into it by wearing traditional masks and making loud noises. The ritual is said to be cathartic for the babies, bringing good health and as well as warding off evil spirits.
I bet there's some interesting YouTube videos of those.
There are actually some awesome YouTube videos of it, and I encourage anybody out there to just Google Japan sumo wrestler crying baby. This festival coincides with Japan's annual Children's Day. And there you go. Who knew it? There's actually some pretty good pictures of the baby who got first place just in looking terrible, crying his head off on the internet. So that has been your random fact of the day.
So welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife. We are absolutely thrilled to have Dr. William Long, who's the Strategic Trauma Medical Director for Trauma Specialists at Emmanuel Legacy Hospital in Portland, Oregon. Dr. Long's also thoracic and vascular surgery board certified, and also is critical care medicine and trauma board certified. Sir, welcome so much to Behind the Knife.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be a part of this.
So can you give us a little bit of background about where you grew up, where you trained to the point where you've become this strategic director in Portland?
Well, I grew up on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, a place, a little town called Salisbury. My dad was the first board certified general surgeon who settled there. He grew up in that area as well. And so I guess it was sort of a Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn existence there for about the first 12 years of my life. And then I went off to a preparatory school in Middletown, Delaware, and actually featured in one of the Hollywood movies with starring Robin Williams. You might have seen the movie. And and then went off to the college in New England, and then on to medical school.
And what brought you to the West Coast?
Well, as usual, there were faculty disruptions where I was. So when I had finished my medical school, there was a lot of excitement going on at the University of Maryland as developing one of the first big trauma centers on the East Coast. And I'd had an opportunity as a medical student to go to Edinburgh, Scotland to get a rotation there in surgery, and I took it. And when I was over there, I was entranced by one of the world's great libraries in surgery, but they also had a great emphasis on clinical diagnosis and physical diagnosis for teaching. And they offered me a job when I got finished medical school to come back. After I finished my year of internship in medicine. Went to Scotland for 3 years, started my PhD work there, and was going to build a career in academic surgery. And then Sir John Bruce, my chair of surgery there, he was a Regius Professor of Surgery in Scotland, and he got cancer to the rectum and died, and everything changed rapidly. And the new chair came in and converted the whole place to essentially gastric inhibition and breast cancer. And that wasn't my interest at that time, so I left Scotland, came back to the United States to do a residency in surgery at Boston University Medical Center. And then I got called by R. Adams Calley, who had built the cardiothoracic surgeon who built the trauma center in Baltimore at the University of Maryland. And he asked me and other colleagues of mine in Edinburgh, Scotland, of all places, to come and help him man the new center they had just opened up. And I took the offer and became a fellow there for 3 years. And at the same time, completed my general surgical residency at the University of Maryland.
Once you arrived to Emmanuel, how did you get interested? What made you decide to focus on, what you do, which is, basically, really improving the efficiency of the trauma care delivery system?
Well, it happened, again, like so many things in life, it happened by accident. It wasn't anything that I all of a sudden had a flash of light and said, this is what I want to do. But R. Adams Calley had a big influence on my life, and he was the head of cardiothoracic surgery at the University of Maryland, and he had the idea that the approach to shock was poorly, not well done, but put it this way, not well done by surgeons who were then covering the emergency departments at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1966, the National Research Council published a paper called Trauma, the Neglected Disease of Modern Society. And it was largely a committee of people who were coming back from Vietnam and other places, and who realized that there were more people dying on the highways each year in Maryland than died in the entire Vietnamese War, and that there was a lack of organization and commitment to having resources available. And up until that time, only the military was scaled up to be able to sit there and provide that kind of that level of service and instantaneous surgery if needed. And so there were five research grants that came out after that paper was published, funded by the National Research Council. Four of the grants were called matching grants for $5 million apiece. And if my memory serves me correctly, one went to Jacoby Hospital in New York, where Louis Del Guercio was head of it. Another went to Sam Powers at Albany Medical Center in New York. A third one went to William Altmaier at Cincinnati in Ohio. A fourth one, I think, went to Francis Moore in Boston. And then there was a $10 million matching grants. In other words, the state had to put up money, and the federal government put up money for this through this. And that was a $20 million grant. So the other four institutions focused on basically doing research at the basic science level. And Cali, basically they took the money and got a helicopter and built, with the aid of the matching grant from the state of Maryland, built a trauma center designed specifically for putting all the things necessary for resuscitation in one place. In other words, an ambulance bay, a helicopter pad, a resuscitation room separate from the main EDs, completely separate from the main emergency department, separate operating rooms right next to the resuscitation bays in the shock trauma center. He had hyperbaric chambers in the basement, three of them actually, that were capable of, one of which was capable of doing open heart surgery, and it was huge. And he had a 16-bed ICU on the fourth floor and research administration on the other two floors. And so when all the money ran out, Cali had a delivery system of patients from all over the state of Maryland, southern Pennsylvania, West Virginia, northern Virginia, and Delaware, coming into the University of Maryland. He had a cash flow and a patient volume from which he could his group could write papers and develop this service. So his gamble paid off. So that was the first step. I know I saw all that developing while I was a medical student. And at that point, I wasn't all that excited about things, but I saw it developing. I saw the fellows that he had recruited, one of which was Dave Boyd, who studied under Cali for 2 years in what was called the Center for the Study of Trauma. It was in the he had a research lab that had two patients that could be monitored at that time, and they were using the old electronics for medicine monitors, and they had studied heavily the cardiovascular dynamics in shock patients. Mm-hmm. You know, they had a hodgepodge of open heart patients who were still in shock. They had septic shock, hemorrhagic shock, the whole group there, and they were doing all these intensive studies there. And some pretty bright guys were interested in following the lead that Cali has started. He also had some money from the U.S. Army through a man named general named Sam Seeley, who had done some work on arterial resuscitation using the ART line as a way to restore blood pressure quicker than putting blood through the venous system. And so these were kind of things that were going on. And as a medical student, I used to go by and chat with these guys and watch what was going on, and got an inkling of what was happening in that area. So I went to say, then I went off to Scotland, and when things did not turn out the way I'd hoped in Scotland, I was going to stay there and make my lifelong career there. I came back, and there wasn't all that much happening at Boston University when I was there. So when Cali called to come back to help staff his unit, I was still only a second year resident at the time, and I took it. And when he got there, he had some interesting people there working. He had Paul Hanashiro, a cardiologist, as a trauma medical director running the surgical unit. And Paul taught us all a lot about how to resuscitate the heart. ATLS was not really up and running all that much at that point. He had Joe Sparazza from the Aberdeen Proving Ground, U.S. Army unit, and he was interested in operations research and systems analysis. Sam Seeley, as I mentioned before, was providing through the Army research grants, and Bill Sacco from the Edgewood Arsenal, not a military person, but he was the biostatistician and a pioneer in developing, as you know, the trauma score and the TRIS scoring system. And on the same campus, but part of the state of Maryland, was the medical examiner's office, and there was a young nurse there, a researcher named Susan Baker. And she was working on the acute injury scale, and I went over to see what was going on. We sat down, and she showed me all of her data, and we worked out that a quadratic equation was the answer to developing the injury severity scoring system. And that became the index for many, many years of how to match the or characterize the severity of injury among patient populations. And the other thing that was happening is that Cali simultaneously was putting what's called SISCOM, S-Y-S-C-O-M, to display on computers all over the state of Maryland the available Maryland resources should a disaster or major traumas occur at any one period of time. We take the patient by helicopter or by land ambulance to the hospital that had the best resources that was closest to the patients. There was a woman that he had working for him, a nurse named Liz Scanlon. She developed the trauma nurse career ladder. I'd never seen this before, but the idea of a trauma resuscitation nurse that was different from an ED nurse or ICU nurse, these were people who went to the resuscitation bays and had an understanding of the pathophysiology of shock and what it takes to get people out of shock. So she developed a cadre of nurses, and then from that group she chose a higher level, usually ones with master's degrees, to become trauma nurse clinicians. And then there was a couple of them that went on to get a PhD, and they became trauma nurse specialists. So there was now a nursing hierarchy that was built up. So as a resident, I saw all this organizational structure that was being put in that you didn't see going on in other diseases to get to the level of expertise that was needed for people who had multi-systems failure or multi-system problems.
Well, that kind of leads into, I know one of the things that Legacy Emmanuel that you helped institute, it's known for, is the mobile surgical transport team and the ECMO and trauma patients. I know you're one of the only institutions in the Northwest that does this. Can you describe how you came to implement this and why?
Well, you know, I grew up in Maryland. Is somewhat similar to Oregon. It's not a rectangle like Oregon is, but it does have a geographical barrier in the middle of the state called the Chesapeake Bay, and Oregon has a mountain range that goes down through the middle of the Cascades. So the state is divided into an eastern half and a western half. And a good part of the state of Maryland, surprisingly, when I was a fellow there, was rural. And we saw patients dying in rural areas who normally, if they had been injured in more urban and suburban areas, they probably would have survived it because the resources were closer and they had more people with expertise. And the question is, how could you basically get these people in quicker? Well, at that stage, there wasn't any real training in most general surgical programs on how to do major trauma resuscitations. Most resuscitations were basically fluid dynamics. In other words, give enough fluid and blood products, and then the blood pressure will come up. And one of the things I learned from Cali as a heart surgeon, that he basically said, when the heart fails, the game is over. And normally after 3 or 4 exchange transfusions, many people would go into heart failure, then pulmonary edema, metabolic acidosis, hypothermia, and then that would be the end of it. And he kept talking all the time about how to restore that. Well, when you put that into the rural circulation, that meant that by the time you sent a helicopter out to pick somebody up who's unstable and in shock and bleeding, in a rural hospital with limited blood bank supplies, by the time the helicopter got there, either they were dead or they loaded them up and started bringing them out, and they died back en route. So when I got to got here to Portland, the Emmanuel Hospital owned the only medevac helicopter in the state, and it was based at Emmanuel. And so it didn't take much to realize that, well, gosh, if we could take blood with us and blood products for 3 exchange transfusions, put a surgeon on there with basic basket or thoracic and general surgical instruments, and an ICU nurse and an OR nurse, you could go out to the rural hospitals, help them stabilize the patient, and if we're successful, then bring them back basically partially or completely resuscitated and complete the critical care and the mop-up surgery at Emmanuel. So we started doing that, and we got a 50% survival with that. And I reported that twice at some of the surgical meetings, submitted for publication, never could get it published for a variety of reasons, I guess. But nevertheless, it worked. That was the beginning of the mobile surgical transport team. Secondly, we also ran into in this state, because of mountains and Pacific Northwest weather in the wintertime, we ran into a lot of accidental hypothermia and cold water drownings. And so we would fly out basically again to help EDs, physicians, to resuscitate these patients. Many of the general surgeons had no experience with those kind of things. So they didn't show up. So it was emergency physicians trying to sit there and resuscitate alone. So we were responsive when they called. We went out and helped them, and we had survivals with that population. Later on, when two perfusionists down in Los Angeles came up with the idea of a portable cardiopulmonary bypass that could be quickly assembled and primed with saline, for example, and be ready to go to have cannulas put into a patient within 5 or 10 minutes of someone appearing on the scene, they were going to try to use that technology to resuscitate cardiac arrest patients that especially got who collapse on the street in urban areas. And one of my colleagues I trained with at UC San Diego, John Hill, and I went down to look, see what they were talking about, what they were proposing, ran into Dr. Trunke there, who was also interested in this potential issue. And we both, the three of us, looked at each other and said, this could be an advantage for trauma patients who basically whose heart was failing, who could no longer support themselves, and would it be of use? And the big question, of course, is whether or not they would bleed to death if you had to heparinize them to put them on bypass. Well, usually by the time people have gotten into prolonged shock, they're already a coagulopathic, and it turns out you didn't have to heparinize them. You just needed to support them, rewarm the heart, and support the heart until it can recover, and then deal with the surgical bleeding at the same time, if there was surgical bleeding.
Yeah.
And so we published a number of papers showing that that was possible. So that we added that to the mobile surgical transport team, bringing a portable bypass unit that was easily set up and could go in the back of a helicopter or a land ambulance. The one that we had weighed about 150 pounds. So that was easily fit into the back of a helicopter, the back of an ambulance, and again, reported that in the literature as well. So that's how the mobile surgical transport team got started. And as we got more experience and talked about it all over the state in southern Washington and talked more about resuscitation with the rural hospital physicians and surgeons, all of a sudden, some of these problems began to disappear, and they got better resuscitations. We didn't see ARDS from too much crystalloid and not enough blood. And the need for the mobile surgical transport team began to disappear. So what happened next, somewhere around in the early 2000 and beyond, the H1N1 virus came in, and this was not trauma, but it was overwhelming pulmonary insufficiency caused by these viral diseases, and people were dying of hypoxemia. So here we had a mobile ECMO system, or portable cardiopulmonary bypass system. We had a delivery system that could take the technology to the patient and bring them back alive, as opposed to, again, trying to go out and take somebody who's already on 100% FiO2 and then try to put them in a helicopter with decreased capabilities if you didn't have the ECMO machine, and then have them die en route. So we applied that technology to the to the patients with H1N1 epidemic that was taking place, and we got a 65-70% survival. So we published that. So the MSTT, or Mobile Surgical Transport Team, found a new reason for being, and even as the hypothermia and the trauma decreased, this enabled us to sit there and provide a service to the region. So the farthest we've been that I'm aware of is a 400-mile radius of Northwest Portland, where Emmanuel is located, and the ECMO system is working very well.
So one of the other interesting aspects that you've brought into trauma care is the direct to the operating room, basically assessment and resuscitation. Can you talk a little bit about how that evolved and what benefits you think that has and what patients you apply it to?
Yeah. Again, these are observations that you make as a medical student that gets reinforced during your residency. So the standard approach for and still taught today in the ATOM course and the ACID course, as well as ATLS, is that you do a left anterior thoracotomy for patients with blunt or penetrating cardiac arrest. And you realize quickly that unless you're going to extend it to a clamshell, there is very little room with a created by a rib spreader going in the fifth intercostal space to get access to the heart. And that means only one person can really see what's going on. And if you're doing the CPR, then no one else can really help you. Because you got both hands in this narrow opening in the chest. So we thought, secondly, is that you need to bring the operating room to the ED if you're going to continue to open up patients in the emergency department. And the lighting is bad, the rooms are cramped, the equipment is not there, and you have your OR team running back and forth between the OR and the emergency department to bring stuff that you may need during a resuscitative thoracotomy. And you thought to ourselves, well, why would you do this when you basically either a floor, an elevator ride up one floor away, or maybe another 50 to 100 feet is an operating room? All you have to do is take them directly to the operating room and not be caught up in the problems with the ED. And so we first did that at UC San Diego, and they had a helipad and emergency department on the ground floor. The resuscitation bays for trauma were up on the fourth floor, and the ORs were on the second floor. And I was lucky. I was a fellow in cardiothoracic surgery there. I had a chief of surgery named Joe Wedley, who not only was a great cardio and pulmonary surgery, but he loved, and for some strange reason, unlike most cardiac surgeons, he loved trauma. And I said, Joe, why are we doing this, trying to open chests in a place where we don't have all the equipment, especially if there's heart trauma? And I said, can we go directly to the operating room? And he supported it. Dr. Orloff, who was chairman of the Department of Surgery, supported it. And that's where we started it, down at UC San Diego. And we had success with it. And that's where, and then I brought that concept to Emmanuel. Then once it got to Emmanuel, we had success with some of these programs that we had implemented here. The board of directors opted to build at that time, $120 million new wing, put the helipad, the ambulance bays, the ED, the four operating rooms dedicated to trauma, the stat lab, the two CAT scanners, and a 14-bed ICU all in one place, all on one floor. No elevators. Everything was linear. You could just move from place to place. You could take care of a lot of patients at one time. And you could go directly to the operating room from the helipad or from the ambulance bay, and had all the resources that you needed to sit there and revive someone. So after we did this for about 10 years, our thoracic surgeon named Carmi Jones, I was up at Harborview, and I would see him at meetings, and he got very interested on this direct to OR. And he said, do you think there really is a difference? And I said, if I write up the information, people will say that's basically self-congratulatory. Why don't you write it up and do a study? So he did a multi-trial study. I'm pretty sure you're aware of that. And he found a 16-fold benefit of going direct to the operating room, especially with penetrating thoracic injuries, and on unstable patients, as opposed to trying to deal with that in the emergency department.
Mm-hmm.
He had Dave Hoyt, who was one of my interns when I was there at UC San Diego as a cardiothoracic, when I was a cardiothoracic fellow. Dave perpetuated the direct OR in San Diego, and he had similar results from that. So that paper was published and showed the benefits of doing that.
Great, sir. Now it's time for our dissection of the day, which is the segment of the podcast where we delve more in depth about a particular surgical or trauma topic. Today, we'd like to talk about trauma in the elderly patient. Specifically, to start us off, you know, when you see a patient in the trauma bay who is, you know, at the extremes of age, who's an older individual, what are some of the special physiologic considerations you have to take into account when approaching that patient?
Well, and from a systems point of view, at the extreme of age in the elderly, you worry about the cardiopulmonary reserve. It's not unusual for many of them to have already pre-existing cardiac disease. Some of them have already had median sternotomies with some sort of heart procedure, either an aortic valve replacement or coronary artery bypass grafting. And, you know, they may have a normal blood pressure in the ED, but that doesn't mean they're well perfused. So we establish a protocol here based on years of doing quality assurance on the outcomes of the elderly patients who come in there, and how many of them develop a coronary event while they're on the trauma service following resuscitation. So we do routinely an EKG, an echo on arrival. If they have edema, they get a BNP, troponins, and a lactate to help us indirectly assess perfusion. If they're diabetic, then there's an increased likelihood they're going to have significant calcific coronary artery disease. And if they have end-stage renal function, then it can double that incidence of coronary artery disease and with significant calcifications. You can double that. And there's a paper that we're hopefully will be presenting that the AAST, which shows that there will be a twofold chance of a person having a coronary artery-related event if they have significant calcific coronary artery disease. So that's one of the main things we focus on is the cardiopulmonary function and also assess the renal function in these patients. If they have poor renal function, then too much fluid, you can tip them over into congestive heart failure. Many of the elderly patients who fall, whatever, are some sort of like polypharmacists. They drink alcohol, they take drugs, many of them die, benzodiazepines, and overdose themselves, get dizzy and fall down, which in turn leads them to have pelvic fractures, spine fractures, and especially cervical spine fractures, depending upon which way that they fell. And then the last part about it is that they have anticoagulants.
Yeah.
And I spent the last 30 years in Oregon trying to get MediAlert bracelets on their wrists, basically stating which anticoagulants that they're taking, so that it gives us a head up of, you know, and on because the newer ones out, the platelet disaggregators and some of the other ones are, you don't, some of your test routine testing is not going to pick up what they have unless you happen to have a trauma elastogram or a Rotem.
Right.
And so having not achieved uniform acceptance of the idea of MediAlert bracelets in the elderly, we now basically get a Rotem we use the Rotem as opposed to a TEG. We think it's faster on almost every elderly patient that comes in.
And who's performing that? Do you say that you get an echo? Do you get an echo in the trauma bay or just on admission once they get up to the ICU? Or who's performing those echoes? Is it the cardiologist or...?
Especially if it's direct OR, but if they're in the trauma bay, if they're over the age of 65, or they've had a previous sternotomy, we get an echo. The echo team is ready to go to do this. They're practically in-house all the time, and we have that information early because it helps you make a decision. Where are you going to put this patient? They might be awake and talking. On the other hand, if they're comatose and are intubated, you'd at least like to know where they're going to go to the ICU. Do they need a swan or not need a swan? So these are some of the decisions. And we learned the hard way that the whether or not they have a murmur, a cardiac murmur or not, does not really tell you how well the heart is working. Many of the elderly are nutritionally overzealous, and so you don't see the neck veins as well to be able to determine that. Now, the FAST examination has been a help. As more and more surgeons have gotten FAST trained, they can at least get an idea or a guess as to whether or not there's a pericardial effusion, there is a little bit of akinesis or hypokinesis of certain parts of the left ventricle. They can see that pretty well. But they can't tell you too much about the valvular disease unless it's heavily calcified. So the echo, I think, is a good screening device to help you decide how much monitoring you're going to do on the patient and where you're going to put the patient, depending upon what you see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sir, can you touch on the quick pearls on reversing these patients that come in with anticoagulants?
And specifically, how are you using the, you know, just practically, how are you using the Rotem in order to get guide that reversal?
Okay. Well, the biggest thing that we see with the Rotem that stands out more than anything else is the fact that they have hypofibrinogenemia. And that helps us trigger whether or not the use of TXA. However, if they have no fibrinogen, the TXA doesn't work all that well.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And but it gives you an idea is that as you start treating them and giving them PCC and seeing whether or not how quickly that's going to correct the hypofibrinogenemia, you can use serial Rotems to see the progress that you're making. You also have the clinical evidence of whether or not they have a coagulopathy, but that's only on the surface. You don't see what's taking place internally. Unless you're going to stay there with the belly open or the chest open to see when the coagulation is really, the coagulants that you're infusing are really working. So we've used that. We find that the serial use of the Rotem is pretty quick, and it's helpful in making those decisions. We have not yet had to put a patient on dialysis, though, to get rid of some of the effects of the platelet disaggregates. Fortunately, we were next to the Oregon Blood Bank here. We use a fair amount of platelets for those that are in platelet disaggregators.
Can you talk a little bit about who you select to, you know, the common scenario we may see is ground level fall in the elderly patient that has multiple rib fractures. I know you've had a lot of experience with rib plating. When do you implement that? Who do you choose to do that? How much do you think it benefits? Is there a certain patient you'll stay away from that? And what's the timing of all that?
Well, you're limiting this conversation rib plating just to the elderly. And people over the age of 65, I'd say a number of them have rib fractures, and I rarely ever plate these people unless they have a flail for which they have to be on the ventilator. We can't get them off the ventilator after 4 or 5 days that we would consider plating them. The oldest ones I've ever plated was 88, but she was a viable lady, very, very viable lady at 88 until she fell off the back deck. Vast majority of them, I'd say one out of 20 we would ever consider plating in the elderly. Most of these people do reasonably well without having to sit there and have a thoracotomy to put plates on. Many of them can be managed with an epidural. A lot of them can be managed with a PCA and just don't need it.
How about any specific injuries? You know, when you see an elderly patient come in, are there any specific injuries that you think about?
Well, it depends upon the mechanism. A lot of them are coming in, they're ground level falls. It's surprisingly how many cervical spine injuries that occur just with a ground level fall, and it helps to know the mechanism of injury. Are they walking along with a walker, are they slipping on the hardwood floor, or does the walker get caught up on the rug or whatever? And many of them are already hunched over, and when they hit, they hyperextend the neck and they get an odontoid or C2 fractures, the most common ones that we see. And it's very easy to underestimate the severity of injury. The CAT scan, fortunately, has been a big asset to help pick up the old these new disease or new fractures on top of degenerative disease that's already present. Pelvic fractures, the other, next one's most common. Then the third one most common that we see are the lumbar fractures. Now, if it's if they land, you know, then there's the fractured hips. And the fractured hips normally don't stay in the trauma center. If it's an isolated fractured hip, we have orthopedic surgeons who do a lot of elective. And after we do the trauma work, we found that this is an isolated fractured hip. They are basically put under the care of a geriatrician and the orthopod doing the consulting work. And we've handled that population in that direction.
Okay, that ends our dissection of the day, and now we're going to transition to our tips and tricks segment, is when we ask our experts to give us some helpful hints to take us out of those sticky situations. And Dr. Long, one of the other things that you do is thoracic surgery, and we'd like to focus a little bit right now about the patient who has a persistent pneumothorax or an air leak after a chest tube is placed. When I was a resident, through all this, it was suction up, suction down, when to maybe bronch, when to take them to the operating room or do some things. How do you evaluate this patient, and what are your tips and tricks to try to get that that air leak to stop and to differentiate between somebody who's got a bronchial stump leak and somebody who might have just a persistent air leak from the lung parenchyma?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the times the answer is very simple, and the chest tube in most cases, which when someone has a persistent air leak, is in too far or not far enough. Or it's in the major fissure. Those are the three most common things. There's another instance where if you take the dressing down and look at where the chest tube enters into through the skin, sometimes you only find one suture on one side of the chest tube, and the chest tube is loose. It pistons in and out between that, and you have to know where the last most proximal hole in the chest tube is. Is it in the pleural cavity, or is it in the subcutaneous space? And that's all adds into the fact where this is it's something that easily could be dealt with by repositioning the chest tube and securing the chest tube so it's at the right spot where it should be in the chest. So I guess that's issue number one. Next issue comes as to whether or not there has, if it's trauma related, whether or not the chest tube is in relationship to the fissure, and I see a number of them. They're put in the mid axillary line, and their chest tube is not directed up along the outside of the lung. It goes into the fissure, and then the lung collapses down around it, and it doesn't suck out the pneumothorax. And if there is a tear of the lung from a rib fracture, it doesn't do the job. So sometimes you need a CAT scan to see where exactly the chest tube is. Most of the time you can figure it out on a regular chest x-ray. The other part that's helpful with the CAT scan is that sometimes you can see a bone fragment. This is rare, maybe 1 in 100, that a bone fragment is sticking into the lung itself, and that will have a persistent air leak, and that will require you probably a thoracoscopy to get that out. People with mediastinal layer should have a bronchoscopy and to make sure they don't have a proximal tracheobronchial injury. Persisting air leaks may need a thoracoscopy. And I go back to the CAT scan. The CAT scan sometimes will show a trapped lung. If the air leak's been going on for quite a while, they'll get a fibrinous line. A lining on the outside of the lung, trapping a lobe or a segment down and leaving an airspace, and that will continue to leak until that is dealt with either by thoracoscopy or thoracoscopic procedure, sometimes a thoracotomy. I've had a few cases where they've had surgery done by elsewhere, and they've had a staple line which has stainless steel staples in it, and people are allergic to the nickel in the stainless steel, and they just leak from the staples. And it's only happened twice in my career, but it was enough to sit there after 2 months of trying to figure out what was going on. We finally located the issue, removed the staples, and sutured the lung, and that stopped it. The other parts are for patients who have had a traumatic thoracoplasty where the lung, the chest wall caves in. Again, you have to be very cognizant of the fact that the ribs can still be sticking into the lung, and that will keep the lung leaking from that standpoint. They might need a rotational of a muscle flap like pectoralis, latissimus dorsi, and if there's an airspace that can't be closed because of chronic fibrosis of the lung, or a pleural patch. We try to stay away from pericardial patches, trying to keep the pericardium pristine for related to as far as the heart's concerned. And you have a bronchial valve and a Heimlich valve for long-term ones if you think it will get better by itself without having to do a thoracotomy on them. So these are some of the quick and dirty approaches.
That's fantastic stuff, and that ends our tips and tricks with Dr. Long.
All right, so we like to end every show with what we call the final five. These are five quick and easy questions that let us get to know our guests a little bit better. Number one, if I were to open up your iPod, what would be the most played music on there? And do you listen to music while you're in the OR?
I don't have much choice over that. It's the anesthesiologist that you normally control that. However, I do have two requests that I won't do the operation if we're going to play in Gordon Lightfoot because he drives me crazy. And secondly, I don't want to hear dirges or something else like that. And I usually ask him to turn it off when we're in a fairly tense situation because we don't want to have a distraction.
Right.
But normally I don't have any preferences, and I would rather not have music. Because I'm sitting there trying to teach a resident most of the time, and I want to make sure that the resident is getting it without having them distracted.
Is it just Sundown or Carefree Highway that bothers you? Or are we talking everything? If you could read my mind, the whole Gordon Lightfoot album, is it all bother you?
I think Gordon did me in with the Wreck of the Fitzgerald, and the moaning and groaning that went with that. So when I came to have surgery myself at Emmanuel Hospital, as they wheeled me into the operating room, they had Gordon Lightfoot on. So you can imagine I was not in a good mood.
I just had to play a little bit of that for you right there.
I appreciate that.
I had to have Gordon right on hand. So number two. Do you have any interests, hobbies, or hidden talents that you might have outside of the operating room?
Well, I have a tree farm that I've probably put about 25 years into now. And I've got about, I take care of about 15 acres and lease out the other 40. But I've enjoyed living in the Northwest of finding the old trees that were brought out along the Oregon Trail by the early pioneers. And you will find that American chestnuts have barely able to survive back east because of the blight. Well, strangely enough, the American chestnuts that were brought out by the early pioneers have survived out here, and then some of them were over 100-some years old. And I go around when I do talks at all these different places. I look around the towns to see if there's an American chestnut. I take cuttings of them and label it and wait till the root supply gets built up after I incubate them for a while and then plant them. So I've got about 200 samples of American chestnuts that came out from God knows where back east along the Oregon Trail and growing on my property. It's been fun.
Number three, can you tell us about a favorite trip or vacation that you've been on?
Pardon, a super vacation?
A favorite trip or vacation that you've been on. Can you tell us about one?
Well, I call it a vacation. I went to Kenya to basically do the equivalent of an ATLS course, trying to get them to organize, at their request, a trauma program. And it was fun. It was interesting to see the logistics in an African nation of just how much needs to be done, and you realize that a lot of the local surgeons are not all that interested in trauma, and how much they're going to have to sit there and establish, I think, an emergency medical residency to get this started. And same thing for training and infrastructure of nurses to sit there and build it up, and then gradually send off some of their young surgeons to learn how to do trauma and give them the tools to deal with it. So I've been to several other countries doing something similar, and it's overwhelming the logistics of what it is. And trauma, of course, as you know, in undeveloped countries is a huge issue.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them have no organized system that I can see. Now there are places like UCSF and University of Washington, and now Oregon Health Science University, just to name a few in my area, are beginning to have a great interest in this, because this gives them the opportunity to send their surgical residents to these countries to see a spectrum of disease they'll never see in this country.
Great. So number four, if you didn't become a surgeon, and you didn't go to medical school even, what other career path would you have chosen?
Well, I went to college at the encouragement of my father, grandfather, and uncle, who are all doctors. They encouraged me to go to pre-law. I did take a lot of philosophy and political science courses, and it didn't strike a bell in terms of a lot of excitement and intellectual interest on it. I considered strongly a career in ocean science. The opportunities, and when I was in school, were limited. There was Scripps Institute Oceanography was basically a graduate type of program, and I was still in an undergraduate. And the other one was at Johns Hopkins. So there wasn't a lot of what I would call good oceanography programs at that time.
Number five, our final question. If you could go back in time and meet yourself on your first day of internship, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
My first day of internship?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Well, again, you were talking about a different era. I don't know if people relate to that. You were largely unsupervised, and I was an intern on straight medicine at the University of Maryland. I graduated earlier, or finished earlier, and started my internship a month and a half early. And you all of a sudden realize that you don't know anything.
Right.
And now you're down in the emergency department to take care of a spectrum of disease for which you're not prepared to do. But fortunately, I had a lot of support from the other people down there, and a lot of amusing anecdotes we could share at some point that occurred. But you get through it, but you learn how much you learn very quickly how much you don't know, and you have to be willing to say, I don't know, I need help. And then it comes in bunches, and it helps you stay out of trouble.
Well, Dr. Long, we've been just so pleased to have you on Behind the Knife, and just wonderful advice, wonderful tips and tricks, and really exploring the differences with the elderly population. And I just want to thank you on behalf of both Kevin and Jason. We hope to have you back in the future and spread the word about Behind the Knife, and we appreciate experts like yourself taking the time to join us.
Well, it's fun. I hope to say people get some insight out of it. I've been very lucky in my career to always have been not quite in the right place at the right time, but as doors open in one area and close in another, it's you have to go with the flow at times, and sometimes it all works out. And so for me, I've been very lucky in the perspective I've had. One of the things that when I went over to Scotland, Sir John Bruce wanted to develop a trauma center in Scotland. There's only one other one in the whole country, and that was over in Glasgow by Ian Lettingham. And so he got me and another British registrar a Moynihan traveling scholarship to go back to the United States and visit every major trauma center in North America, including Canada. And, I mean, who would believe an American going to a foreign country and working in a department of surgery would get money to go back and see his own country at an advantage that you would never have done in your own country. And I got to see and meet some of the world's top surgeons on that trip, sponsored by the British government. You can't beat that with a stick.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm not sure if this is your first podcast, but welcome to the world of podcasting. And again, we appreciate you taking the time out.
All right. Well, I hope I didn't embarrass you.
Have a great day and enjoy the great Pacific Northwest. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindtheknife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience, so give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. And we're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions, and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct. Fash is closed, and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.